judging the balance and who should check that they've got it right. And that's it.
Thank you, Sandra. So that brings us to the end of our first session. We have now a 15-minute break. We will start very promptly at 4 o'clock.
4:15.
No, we'll start very promptly at 5 minutes to 5 minutes to 4. So, Crystal, you don't need Connor Walsh from the National Resource Institute at Greenwich University, and Mark Jarman, the head of Earth Observation and Agri-Tech lead at the Space Applications Catapult at Hull. So, over to them. They've got to self-organise their speech.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. So, as has been mentioned, I'm sharing the stage with my colleague Mark here. So, in the interest of time, I won't spend a great amount of your time introducing myself, but suffice it to say, I'm an environmental scientist. I consider myself a cautionary tale in this interdisciplinarity, working with everyone from belching cyclists to farting cows in my time. I've also been involved with various organisations looking at the impacts of climate change on food security. With that in mind, my talk will be based around three main areas. Firstly, introducing some important trends that we've observed at a global level in food security. Give a very quick overview on some of the most important stresses that we may have to contend with in the coming decades. And finish off with, admittedly, a very amateurish perspective on the potential role of space science from the perspective of environmental sciences. So, you've probably all heard of Robert Malthus, that effectively predicted that as the population grows arithmetically, the capacity to produce food grows dramatically, and we're going to reach a point where we have much reduced capacity to feed ourselves. Thankfully, we didn't observe that in the future, as we can see that cereals, as a very important source of food, that are contributing to about 75% of global calorie intake, has grown at a faster rate than population. But hang on, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're out of the woods. It has been estimated that by about 2050, the global crop production has to increase by between 100 to 70% due to increasing not just in population, but also in per capita demands for different foodstuffs. And the amount is based not just on population growth, but also where populations are projected to grow. The UN projects that on the mid-range, we are going to see a global population between 9 and 10 million by 2050. And about 80% of that is going to manifest in developing regions. And we can see the FAO estimated the biggest rise in per capita demand for foodstuffs are going to be within these regions that are likely to experience a significant growth in population. So we can see this growth in our capacity to produce food as an indication of increasing intensity of farming, or rather the resource intensity of the crop systems of which we depend. So if we look at these two diagrams very quickly, the diagram on the left demonstrates the role of nitrogen fertilizers in ensuring that crop yields have continued to increase. If you, I would like you to just briefly have a look at the dotted black line and the white diamond reflected on the right-hand axis. This shows that the percentage of the world's population are dependent on the production of nitrogenous fertilizers is increased. Similarly, the intensity of fertilizer production or the intensity of fertilizer application has increased up until recent years and tailed off. Also, we can see that in terms of water consumption, that is the consumption of surface and groundwater, water for agriculture is demonstrated on the right-hand figure by the blue area of the curve, has increased significantly, even though it's facing increasing consumption with water demands for industrial applications. So we're looking at a world where our continued population growth, our continued food consumption is effectively sustained by increasing resource demands in terms of nitrogen fertilizers and energy required to produce them, but also demands for water. So what does that have to do with food security? Well, I like to think about, as a bit of a tinker, I like to think in simple terms, and when I think of food security, I like to think about things in terms of import dependency of different regions. That is the rate, the proportion of imports to overall domestic consumption of different commodities. And one of the interesting indicators we can look at is the import security of cereals across different very important consumptive markets. These are the countries that consume the largest proportion globally of cereals. And you can see various trends. So, for example, Egypt has remained a significantly high import dependency, demonstrated by the purple bar at the top. However, we see some slight warming trends and some slightly more optimistic ones. We can see places like Russia have significantly increased their capacity to export, having a negative import dependency, decreasing significantly since the early 2000s, whereas slightly more worryingly, really large markets such as China has slipped out, has skirted around the neutral position, but since around 2007, they've become more import dependent. Well, why is this important? Well, globally, many of the regions also consume large amounts of grain, also produce them, which means that we might not have the capacity to rely on them in the future as being very significant exporters if we need them, if we need other regions to become, if we need consumption in other regions to become facilitated by these large producers. So just by example, if we look at the trends in grain production and exports in America, we can see by comparing with the annual trade, the annual change in production and exports, we can see that some years, like 2004, demonstrate a similar trend in terms of if production grows by an X percent, we can see exports growing by a similar percentage. However, this has not been replicated unilaterally. Out to the future, we can see some years where production grows, but exports decrease significantly. So we're becoming slightly more worried about whether or not our dependency on very large producers is sustainable in the future. Now, perhaps this becomes a bit more understandable if you look at some of the important trends of trade. If we compare the distribution of the big traders, in this case the importers, from 1975 to more recently, we can see that the largest proportion of trade of importers was around 6% represented by around 10 countries and very large importers such as Japan and the former USSR. More recently, you can see a greater divergence, a greater distribution of important imports and important regions that demand grain. So that by currently, the top 10 only contribute to around 40 or so percent of global imports. So we see a diversity of import demand. However, if you look at exporters, if you look at the regions that supply large quantities of grain, we can see a slightly different trajectory in that we see a much greater dependence on a smaller number of exporters. But currently, the top 10 exporters contribute around 70% of global trade. So we see kind of opposite trends in terms of the flow of big importers and big exporters. Now, what does this really mean if we look at food security? Well, the implication being that we could envision a world that becomes much more dependent on a smaller number of regions. This becomes more pronounced if we accept that we are going to have to adapt to some form of climate change impact. This diagram demonstrates the potential changes in yields under a scenario in which global average temperatures increase by 4% in comparison, by 4 degrees, sorry, compared to pre-industrial levels by the end of the next century, which is where we're headed unless things change dramatically. And we can see that many regions of the world are likely to face significant reductions in yields, more predominantly within the lower latitudes. Now this is for wheat, one of the most important cereal crops and a staple food source. Interestingly, there is some suggestion that some of the important exporters are likely to actually benefit from changing climate change through increased yields. So again, it's not necessarily all doom and gloom, but it does have implications for how the distribution of different imports might be represented in the future. So what does this mean in terms of individual countries? So some of the work I've been involved in with colleagues in Channel Post and others has been trying to demonstrate different scenarios of future climate change impacts. And very, very quickly, this is just a very quick example of comparing two future trajectories for import dependency for Egypt. And I'm happy to go into a bit more detail speaking under 4 degrees world in which there's significant change in the climate, significant impact in climate change, but we don't have the same capacity to expand the productive area. You can envision Egypt becoming almost entirely dependent on imports, which has implications for security, for social cohesion, and we certainly saw the results recently. Okay, so if you want to try to reduce climate change impacts, well, unfortunately, there's limited opportunity to do so, and we are becoming reliant on what has been termed a magic technology, but it's effectively a biomass CCS pathway where we use biofuel to capture carbon in a form that can be then sequestered into geographic and lithospheric atmospheres and locked away. So we're basically taking in plant matter and locking it away. But in order to prevent the climate change, we're effectively dependent on bio-CCS coming online around 2050. And this, of course, has implications for other stresses on the land. If this study tries to look at, well, if we want to reduce competition with other land uses, we're going to have to find places that are less constrained and are less prey to the types of competitions for land and resources. But they, in turn, have their own challenges, such as risks to degradation or additional food and competition. So even trying to reduce the competition with direct crop areas in order to produce biofuel is going to be very, very challenging. So before I hand over, I would just like to very quickly give my quick 2 cents worth of how we can use space observation data. Broadly speaking, there's a huge amount of uncertainty as to the likely impact of climate change and how we're going to try to increase productivity while also adapting to the impacts of climate change. So we need to have a better evidence base for understanding these constraints. So now, as you've seen before, we're going to rely significantly on bioenergy, and one of the main areas that have been, or one of the main geographic regions that are deemed to be the future breadbaskets for bioenergy, are Africa, because compared to other regions, Africa has had limited capacity to increase its yield in the past, and had limited use of irrigated land, or the amount of land irrigated is quite healthy compared to other regions. So, also, we want to try to have a capacity to value our models using, for example, geographic data. This study on the left-hand side was looking at potential capacity to change coffee cropping in Nicaragua based on rainfall as the first rainfall determines when coffee plants flower. So meteorological data was vital in demonstrating using these different adaptation models. And finally, I think observation data is really important in trying to demonstrate trends in resource demands. This is a time-lapse video showing the growth of irrigated farms in Saudi Arabia, which are dependent on fossil water resources, which are very, very limited planet resources. You can see using observation data the trends associated with water demand in the future. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Thank you, Connor, and on with the journey to do with food. So, I mean, I've been very fortunate over the last kind of 7 or 8 years. I run a startup using drones and satellite precision farming, worked right across the supply chain. In my role now with Caspor, I've been all over the world dealing with farmers. And fantastic thing when you think about future security is farmers are dealing with the same challenges, whether you're in Cuba, whether you're in the UK, the States, Malaysia. Everybody knows there's huge challenges in society to grow more with less. And we have to be clever, we have to be smart. If we think about it from an agricultural perspective, how are we going to do that? Well, we've got to combine sound agronomy and crop science. We're dealing with the sector here. We're dealing with real knowledge, real expertise. We have to enable public policies. You know, it's all good thinking about doing things to do with food security, but unless we put the right policies in play at multiple levels, whether it be at the regional level through local authorities, right the way up to the food and agricultural organization, things will not change and we cannot grow more with less. And we've got to embrace technology. Because farmers, although they're traditional and quite slow, they love technology. Boys and their toys. I mean, how many new tractors do you see? Big machinery. People want to use information. And we really are moving towards a much more information and connected and centric world with things like drones, 5G, blockchain. All these information technology sources are going to make a big difference. Fantastic thing about satellites is they are the key enabler to many things to do with agriculture, whether it be connectivity, huge input in things like IoT and field connected sensors. Navigation, pretty much you go on any farm now and you will see an RTK enabled machine.
The reason that's become mainstream is because the second-hand market is there. Farmers have to have access to machinery. And then we've got wild-scale Earth observation data available to them. And they're providing such